Hello, my name is Roger Watson and I'm the Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Advanced Nursing, and welcome to the JAN podcast. These occasional podcasts will be a miscellany of my reflections on working as an Editor-in-Chief, some hot topics in academic publishing, and occasional contributions from guest editors. This is the JAN podcast of 5th of September 2015. Who should be listed as an author and who should not? The issue of authorship on scientific papers is something I'm often asked about when I do writing for publication workshops. There's plenty of writing and publication on this issue. There are plenty of opinions and there's plenty of guidance. But the issue of authorship on scientific papers is always worth visiting again. In 2013, in volume 68 of the Journal of Advanced Nursing, from pages 2599 to 2601, the combined editorial might of the journal, led by Mark Hayter, wrote an excellent editorial called Who Writes, Whose Rights, and Who's Right? Issues and Authorship. And we opened this editorial with the following statement. Authorship is personally and professionally sensitive. Collaborative relationships, careers, and research team sustainability depend on demonstration of output, and publications are the easiest metric. One of the most common ethical issues editors encounter is authorship disputes. In my role as an editor and editor-in-chief, both of the Journal of Clinical Nursing and now Journal of Advanced Nursing, I can vouch for the fact that authorship issues are very common. In fact, the first dispute I ever dealt with ethically when I became editor-in-chief of the Journal of Clinical Nursing almost within the first week was an authorship issue. I dealt with many since then, and on the Journal of Advanced Nursing likewise. And they continue to come in, and they are rarely fully resolved. Now, the issues in authorship can be boiled down to two basic problems. One is when authors are on papers when they shouldn't be there, either having been added in error or deliberately, and the other is authors being omitted from papers, either in error or deliberately. Of course, when issues arise, the job of the editor-in-chief is to try and get to the root of whether omissions have been, on the one hand, accidental or deliberate, and then, of course, what precisely can be done about it. Now, in my view, both of these situations are very sad when they arise. Adding people in error is wrong, or adding them deliberately is wrong for whatever reason. Sometimes people actually want themselves to be added to papers and force themselves on, but these are the sort of things that have to be ascertained. As bad as that is, it's not as bad as missing people off deliberately. That is really disastrous. I'm not trying to say one action is better than the other, but if somebody is missed off a paper, no amount of corrigenda or addenda to that paper can actually change the byline. Once the paper's published and somebody's name is not on the list, it can't be added to it. So the paper forever appears with the wrong list of authors on it. If somebody's name is added in error, then again an addendum can go out. But essentially, same thing applies. Their name remains on that paper. The byline can't be changed once it's published. Under some circumstances, databases like CINAHL and PubMed can make changes to the list of authorship that's advertised on the internet. However, when you go to the paper and download the PDF, the authorship remains the same, whether it's erroneous in terms of omitting an author or adding an author in error or deliberately. The most commonly referred to and cited guidance, especially in the fields of medicine, health and nursing, are the ICMJE guidelines, the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors guidance. I'm not going to read them out verbatim, but essentially what they say is that anyone who is an author on a paper should have contributed to the design, the analysis and to the writing of the paper, and should have approved the final manuscript before submission. Now, I think most people who are involved regularly in writing for publication would understand that fulfilling all of those is quite difficult. In fact, one of the leading medical journals in the world, the BMJ, the British Medical Journal, has actually come out in favour of a more attenuated form of the ICMJE guidance, which in fact we follow at the Journal of Advanced Nursing, which says that anyone who is listed as an author should have contributed to the design or the analysis or the writing up, and that everyone should agree to the final manuscript before it's submitted. So at one level it looks quite simple. If you've done those three things and approved the manuscript, you should be an author. If you haven't done any of them and not approved the manuscript, then you shouldn't be. However, disputes still arise. So clearly, some people either don't understand the guidance, or they don't know about it, or worse still, they know about it, and they try to get round it. In our editorial in the Journal of Advanced Nursing on authorship, we cited verbatim what was said in the BMJ as follows. Contributors should include all those who have added usefully to the work. They might include somebody who suggested the idea and design for the study but did nothing further, or somebody who collected many of the data but was not concerned with design or analysis. I think you'll agree that's a fairly generous description of authorship. It's one with which I personally agree, but I know that some people don't agree with it. However, that's what it says in the BMJ, and at JAN we more or less agree with that. One of the prime examples of where authorship issues arise is in publications from PhD thesis. I have heard some colleagues say that supervisors should take no part in publishing alongside PhD students if they want to publish from their work. That's up to them, and certainly it's none of our business to co-author with them. I don't agree with that. I think most sensible people don't. For one reason, if you've been the supervisor, you've played a significant part in the work. Perhaps not the writing up and not necessarily the analysis, but you've certainly had a huge part to play in designing the study, and you've also guided it all the way through, and you should know almost as much about that study as the PhD student. Also, most PhD students are keen to publish from their thesis, and very often they will need the help and indeed the guidance and probably much of the writing to be done by their PhD supervisor. So on the one hand, the PhD supervisor who provides such guidance and writing deserves to be an author, but also the paper may not be written without the help of the supervisor. So publishing with PhD students is a great help to the student in getting papers out, helps them to get their foot on the publication ladder, and it helps them to build up their CVs. They may well have written their PhD thesis single-handed, but of course, as we all know, writing articles for publication is very different from writing a PhD. However, there are instances where PhD supervisors are left off papers by PhD students. I've certainly had the experience of being left off a paper by a student once. I didn't say anything, but I was rather surprised. However, other papers did appear with me. So I've got first-hand experience of what this is like. On the other hand, there are instances where PhD supervisors take the work and publish it without acknowledging the PhD student. The first of these is a mistake. It's not fatal. It doesn't damage anyone necessarily. It may damage the relationship. But the second one, where the PhD supervisor takes the data, writes up the paper and doesn't include the student, however much work the student has or has not done to that paper, is just plain wrong, because the data, the analysis, the work belongs to them. We rarely have to deal with disputes. In fact, I've never had an instance of having to deal with a dispute about the order of authorship of an article that once it's published. But I think the case of publishing with PhD students is a very good example of where a sensible distribution of authorship in terms of order is quite clear. In my view, the PhD student should always be the first author, regardless of how much work they've done on the actual paper. And as a matter of courtesy, I think the final authorship should go to the main supervisor, because final authorship often indicates not so much the greatest contribution, but the greatest seniority in the team. And others who've played a part in the work, possibly statistical advice and second supervision and so forth, should go somewhere in between the first and the last authors. But that's just my advice. It doesn't really influence or have any bearing on the actual issue of authorship, which is far more important. And the other incidences where authorship arises is always when people work in teams. Of course, a PhD supervision group is a team in a way, but beyond that, people work in research teams. And it's usually there where editors and editors-in-chief encounter problems. Editors can't actually solve these problems. We can give guidance in advance. That's all we can do. We are, of course, obliged to investigate them when they arise, but the dispute ultimately has to be resolved between the team. These issues normally arise when someone has been omitted from a paper, of course. There are rarely instances when there are complaints about people being added to papers. However, it does happen. And it shouldn't happen. And I actually think the grey area is not when people should be authors and should be added to a paper if they've actually done some of the work. I think the grey area is really adding people to papers when they've done a peripheral amount of the work and wondering whether they actually have made a significant contribution. And that's quite difficult to work out. I think some guidance here is as follows. If somebody has merely edited a paper, in other words, taken what's written and made it more readable and more comprehensible, unless that's a really significant amount of work, I think that that doesn't merit authorship. However, if somebody has done that kind of work on a paper and noticed that there's something substantially wrong with it, perhaps in the analysis or the presentation or the argument, and add substantially to that, I think they may well then have a claim to authorship. None of these things are automatic. In either direction, I think these things need to be negotiated. In my view, people giving papers to others to read and to edit would always be generous if a significant contribution has been made. The case of translators of papers is a grey area and that's not quite settled yet, but I'm personally quite happy to see translators included in authorship lists. I know that all they've done is taken the words and translated them from one language into another, but that's a far more substantial and significant contribution than simply taking the words in one language and making them better on that language. However, I'm sure that people may have alternative views to me on that one. I'd be very happy to hear them. Of course, the main issue here is avoiding these disputes, and there's plenty of guidance around this. We cited some of this in our editorial in the Journal of Advanced Nursing, and we cited the guidance of the United Kingdom Research Integrity Office, which says as follows: researchers should address issues relating to publication and scholarship, especially the roles of all collaborators and contributors, at an early stage of the design of a project, recognising that subject to legal and ethical requirements, roles and contributions may change during the time span of the research. Decisions on publication and authorship should be agreed jointly and communicated to all members of the research team. We cited that because, frankly, we couldn't put it any better ourselves. Alongside such agreements in research teams, and I've been part of research teams where this has been well managed and part of research teams where it hasn't been so well managed, and the ones where it's well managed are always the happier ones, and in actual fact, if it's well managed, they tend to be the more productive ones where publications are actually produced. But of course, the key to this is holding proper research team management meetings, minuting them and recording those minutes and making them available for people to refer back to in the case of any doubt or dispute. So planning the publications from a research project, while to some it sounds odd to be doing it at the beginning before you have the data, should be done at the beginning of the project. You should have some idea what the output should be, and you should be doing it at that stage. And the main reason for this is to avoid disputes later on. And as an editor-in-chief, I'm strongly in favour of this, because the last thing we want to do is to be embroiled in disputes between authors. Believe me, we have plenty of other ethical disputes, such as plagiarism, duplication and fabrication, to deal with. And we feel that authors should be grown up and should be responsible and should have this issue of authorship sorted out well before a paper is even written, let alone submitted for publication.
This podcast was produced in association with youpublicationslimited.com.